there's been a weeks-long prison strike going on across the country, organized by inmates and activists on the outside, calling for, among other things, an immediate end to prison slavery. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery and involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime. And prisoners have long worked inside prisons and on the outside. We've reported on the prison inmates who volunteer to fight wildfires. What's the story to prison labor, the backstory? Let's take a look with Brian Ballow. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Robin.
And Nathan Connolly. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, Robin.
They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. So, Nathan, give us some of this backstory. The strike began August 21st. It's set to end September 9th. And those dates have historical significance we've touched on. Other than that, what else is significant about a prison strike?
Well, this is absolutely a historically minded movement. I mean, they've mapped out a series of days that really do mark the killing of George Jackson in San Quentin, California's facility in August 21st of 1971 and hope to end it on September the 9th, marking the Attica prison rebellion in New York of that same year, 1971. This also actually overlaps with the rebellion in Southampton County, Virginia of Nat Turner in 1831. And so the language about slavery is exactly meant to connect those dots between present-day incarceration, rebellion against that incarceration, even going back to rebellions against slavery. In the United States, I mean, the history of incarceration runs through the very beginning. You have debtors' prisons in the 17th century that overlap with the beginning of the plantation economy, and people would try to escape. So just as incarceration is an early element of American society in one form or another relative to labor and debt, pushing back against that incarceration is similarly a kind of American tradition.
Yeah, we'll talk about forced labor, Brian. And by the way, the 13th Amendment, you know, bans slavery except as punishment for a crime. In modern day, some of the work that's done in prisons is voluntary. But talk about, you know, labor as part of punishment. When did that start?
Well, it started really at the beginning of formal prisons, originally called penitentiaries. It is amazing the amount of work that prisoners did even before the Civil War. One statistic shows that the value of prisoners' work in 1865 at the end of the Civil War was worth $30 million, more or less. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but that's worth tens of billions of dollars in labor today. They made things and they also worked for people. They were contracted out even before the end of the Civil War. After the Civil War, the number of African Americans who were jailed and then forced to do contract labor while in jail was just astronomical.
Well, we'll talk about this, Nathan, because this was clever or insidious re-enslavement. Blacks, free blacks, were arrested for minor infractions for the purpose of jailing them and then leasing them out to people who needed them for work.
Right. In the late 19th and early 20th century, convict leasing was a huge problem, was, you know, largely seen as helping to undermine the ability of organized labor, as well as to provide cheap sources for businesses to, again, rebuild the South in ways that they thought was necessary. And so in response to that exploitation, you have similar kinds of problems of people trying to run away, in some cases mutilating themselves to keep from working, killing, you know, work bosses. I mean, all of this is a very constant fixture in the story of incarceration in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Okay, we come to the 20th century, and Congress enacts a series of restrictions on prison-made goods. Brian, pick that up.
Well, as labor unions became stronger, they began to push back against having to compete, this free labor, having to compete against, in essence, enslaved labor or prison labor. And as you know, Robin, during the New Deal, labor was part of that New Deal coalition, and Congress passed a couple of acts in the mid-1930s that began to limit the ability of prisoners to make goods in prison.
I just have to say, I was not around at that time, but yes, I am aware of the New Deal. But this also led to other kind of radical prison reforms. Prisoners wore normal clothing instead of the pinstripes. There were not just guards, but educators, psychiatrists. Talk a little bit about that, the effects of the prison reform movement.
You're absolutely right. And there's always been another side to prisons. There's been the punitive side. As Nathan has stressed, there's been the side that has forced labor from marginalized groups. But there always also has been this effort to reform the prisoner itself. I just have to hit you with my favorite name for society, the Philadelphia Society for Alleviating the Miseries of Public Prisons, started in the early 19th century. And Ben Franklin was actually a member of that. And what they thought prisoners could do for people was give them time to reflect. And the notion was that reflection would turn into repentance. By the 20th century, and you nailed it, Robin, social science was leaving its imprint on prisons, and there was a very well-meaning effort to really rehabilitate prisoners.
But then, Nathan, what happened? Because we bring us up, you know, we bring ourselves up to the late 1900s, and or, you know, later we see 1971, the Attica uprising had a lot of sympathy, actually. You know, so many died. How did it go from prison reform in the early 1900s and then uprisings in the later?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's no real wall between the civil rights struggle in the streets and the movement inside these prisons to reform and to try to use direct action. In some cases, you know, nonviolent direct action to try to get things done. And it's in the failure of reform that you then get the uprisings that you see in Attica in 1971. So in the wake of those kinds of struggles, you see people expanding law and order, expanding tough on crime approaches, and in some cases really beefing up a somewhat militaristic approach to social problems.
Right. It goes from being a correctional facility to correct, you know, behavior to a place that is going to be maintaining law and order. And we're going to leapfrog there to the crackdown, the drug crackdowns in the 1980s, and the prison population's just, you know, swelling. But tie it back to labor, because we know that there was most recently under President Obama another prison reform movement, an attempt to winnow down prison populations, release people with small offenses, an understanding that more young blacks, for instance, were being arrested and jailed for drug crimes than whites doing perhaps the same crime. So that kind of thinking. But come back to labor, because most recently, in our reporting on prisoners being used to fight wildfires, for instance, or work in kitchens and cook food and do laundry for pennies, many prisoners say that's what gave them a sense of responsibility and maybe even a skill for outside prison. So talk about how labor in prison is viewed today.
On the one hand, you have these low wages. On the other hand, you have people who aren't working at all or aren't in some ways fulfilling the earlier vision of, say, a Ben Franklin about the prison as a reformative space. So being incapacitated becomes a defining feature of also being behind bars. And so both of those, a kind of exploitation but also a lack of movement or improvement, are really defining what the experience of being incarcerated is like today.
I just wanted to add a word about another kind of labor that's become so important in this equation. That's the labor of the people who work in prisons, prison guards, and the companies that run for-profit prisons, the private sector companies. And I'll just give you one statistic. In 1985, states, and that's where most of the prisons are run, states spent $6.7 billion on prisons. In 2016, they spent $57.7 billion. And that's why many people call this the prison industrial complex, because there are powerful vested interests now who have a very big stake in making sure that those prisons stay in business. And to stay in business, they need prisoners.
You know, Robin, it's rare that as historians we get the chance to really bear down and make a kind of immediate impact on a living debate. But I have to say that one of the things that kind of ties us together for us is that many of our colleagues as historians are working in this area to document the history of American prisons and struggles against inhumane incarceration. So it's really important that both the prisoners and the larger populace gets a sense of just how deeply these roots go from today back to the start of the country.
Which, by the way, started with many prisoners who were jettisoned here from other countries. That's Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. We'll link you up. It's fantastic. You just got a taste. Guys, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.